Okay, the second meeting of the seventh session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is now called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, distinguished observers, friends, ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon we shall take up agenda item 3, special theme, climate change, biocultural diversity and livelihoods. According to our program of work, we shall have a dialogue with agencies. But before I will present the paper, and my colleagues, Mr. Ahmed Joglaf and Akaluk Linge, will speak in the panel. I would just like to speak on some organizational arrangements for this session. As you know, the number of persons attending this session has significantly increased over the previous years. So, given the large number of participants, I hope that I will be able to have full cooperation from all of you so that the members of the forum could hear views of all the participants and thereon make appropriate recommendations to the Economic and Social Council. On the issue of list of speakers, we shall follow the practice established in the forum at previous sessions. Since we have limited time for each substantive item to accommodate all those participants who wish to make statements, I shall impose a time limit for the observers of the session according to the number of speakers on my list. The speaker should make shorter statements and provide the secretariat with hard copies of the longer version of their statements so that this could be subsequently put on the website. In this connection, I should like to appeal to participants from Indigenous Peoples organizations to coordinate amongst themselves in order to make consolidated group statements on the items under consideration. By group statements, I mean groups of organizations present at this session. As we did at previous sessions, I shall give priority to caucus statements and collective statements by groups of organizations present here. Meanwhile, I would encourage observers to inscribe on the lists of speakers for each item within the secretariat. Also, I would like to briefly advise as regards NGOs with visual recording equipment in the conference room. In order to ensure that the use of visual recording equipment by NGO delegates does not disrupt the meeting, please follow the established guidelines as directed by the conference officers. We are now taking the name of Indigenous Peoples Organizations, NGOs, speakers list for agenda item 3. Please line by the wall. I was given instructions that please line by the wall and do not block the doors. Please keep your voices down so as not to disturb the meeting. And the speaker's list for this item will remain open until the end of this session at 6 o'clock p.m. And then we will be opening a list for the speakers tomorrow on item 6, half day on the Pacific, and item 4, implementation of the recommendations of the 6 mandated areas of the Permanent Forum. So now we will continue. We will now deal with the agenda item 3, which is on climate change. And as you might have seen in the documents, there is a special report that my colleague Akaluk Linge and I prepared, which is document number E/C19/2008/10. And the document is entitled Impact of Climate Change Mitigation Measures on Indigenous Peoples and on their territories and their lands. So, So now I will introduce the paper, and then I will call on Mr. Ahmed Joglaf, the Executive Secretary of the Convention on Biological Diversity, after I introduce the paper. And then after him, I will call on my colleague Akaluk Linge to speak about the also on the paper, but more focused on the Arctic. So let me turn your attention to the document that I mentioned earlier. This is document number 10, and the title of the document is Impact of Climate Change Mitigation Measures on Indigenous Peoples and on Their Territories and Lands. This is a report that was mandated by the sixth session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, which appointed special rapporteurs to prepare a report on the impact of climate change mitigation measures on Indigenous peoples. If this paper, if you take a look at this paper, basically what we did was to look at the impact of climate change on Indigenous peoples on their lands, and then so we looked at the global effects, and then there's a special section on the Arctic effects because of the special characteristic of the Arctic. The third part deals with climate change mitigation and adaptation measures. And then the fourth part is the issue of impact of climate change mitigation measures on Indigenous peoples and their lands. And then the fifth part is on conclusions. And then we have a long 4 pages on recommendations. I'll not read through the document because you have this document with you already. I will just highlight some of the important points that I would like you to consider, especially when you're going to make your interventions. First, of course, we know that climate change has suddenly become a very high issue on the priorities of the international community. And this has happened through the years, especially after the report, the fourth Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which was released just before the Bali Convention Conference of Parties last December 2007. Because this fourth IPCC report has said that some action really has to be taken to reduce emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, and to lower the temperature of the world, not to go beyond 2 degrees centigrade. No, and then a Stern report, which was the economics of climate change, also was released subsequently. And this report basically said that we have to address climate change as soon as we can, because if we don't, the cost of climate change itself will even be more than the costs that will be incurred if we are going to address it as we should in this within this period. So those reports really caught the attention of the world, and of course we had Al Gore, who won the Nobel Prize, and the IPCC also won the Nobel Prize. So somehow it became very high up in the international agenda. However, for Indigenous peoples, we always have said that Indigenous peoples have actually been feeling the impacts of climate change even before the IPCC came with the reports. And this is because Indigenous peoples are working with the land. They are the ones closely living, you know, having a very close relationship with the land. And anything that happens on the land or on the waters is felt immediately by Indigenous peoples who are living off the land, no? And that's really the reason why Indigenous people, since time immemorial, have been observing these kinds of changes in the climate and its impacts on them. Then we went, there was, during the Bali Conference, some of us went to the Bali Conference, and we held a series of side events with Indigenous peoples. And in the side events, some of the key impacts that the Indigenous representatives presented can be summarized as follows. No? First, there are more diseases associated with increasing temperatures and vector-borne and waterborne diseases, such as cholera, malaria, and dengue fever. No? And this is especially felt in the tropical and subtropical areas. Secondly, the worsening drought conditions and desertification has led to increased numbers of forest fires that affect land use, subsistence agriculture, and hunting and gathering livelihoods, and this brought about a serious loss to biodiversity. No? Thirdly, excessive rainfall and prolonged droughts resulting in more occurrences of dust storms that damage grasslands, seedlings, and other crops, including livestock of pastoralists and nomadic indigenous peoples. Fourth, coastal and riverbank erosion and rising of rivers caused by higher temperatures, the thawing of permafrost, and the melting mountain snow, glaciers, and sea ice. Fifth, reduced populations of animal species due to warmer temperatures, and there are also the appearance of new marine species due to warmer seawater, and therefore there are changes in animal travel and migration routes. Sixth, increase in new types of insects and lengthened lifespans of endemic insects like spruce beetles, which destroy trees and other vegetation. And finally, the coastal erosion exacerbated by a rise in sea level has led caused by stronger hurricanes and typhoons, leading to loss of land and property and dislocation of indigenous peoples. As was mentioned earlier, there are now climate change refugees, loss of mangrove forests, and loss, and especially in the forest and coastal regions. No? Food insecurity due to difficulty of maintaining viable fish populations, coral bleaching due to higher sea temperatures, and then increasing human rights violations, displacements, and conflicts due to expropriation of ancestral lands and forests for biofuel plantations, whether these are soya, sugarcane, jatropha, oil palm, corn, among others. Also because of increasing pests, locusts, rats, spruce beetles, etc., which damage the crops. And there are now increasing costs of food due to competition with biofuels, exacerbating food insecurity. So these are just some of the few impacts, direct impacts of climate change on indigenous peoples. And it is because of this reason that indigenous peoples really felt that the attention given to them by the international community and even by the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change is very woefully inadequate, and therefore they are pushing very hard these kinds of bodies to put more support and give more visibility to the issues of indigenous peoples. But that's not the only issue. The other issue that affects indigenous peoples is the issue of climate change mitigation measures. No, as we know, in the Kyoto Protocol, the climate change mitigation measures are three market-based mechanisms, which is called the Clean Development Mechanism, Joint Implementation, and Emissions Trading. And these are all market-based mechanisms. And therefore, some of these measures are having also adverse impacts on indigenous peoples. So when indigenous peoples analyze, when we look at the issue, we were convinced that this issue is not just an energy issue, because that's the way the Climate Change Convention is addressing it. It's an environmental issue, definitely, but it's also an issue of equity, social justice, and human rights. No, we, from the indigenous perspective, unless we address the issue of climate change from a human rights-based perspective and also from an ecosystems approach, any measure that is being taken will really be very inadequate, and it will not address indigenous people's issues. And therefore, when we looked at the mitigation measures that are being taken, we saw the kinds of impacts that these have on the indigenous peoples, especially in terms of their rights being violated when the biofuel plantations are expanding, when renewable energy projects like large-scale hydroelectric dams are being put into their communities, when carbon sinks are being expanded because they are supposed to absorb greenhouse gas emissions. All of these measures are really causing the displacement of indigenous peoples, land alienation, and of course, human rights violations. In the report, we have cited some bad practices that we have found out in terms of how indigenous peoples are being driven away from their lands and because of the creation or establishment of these plantations. But we also discuss about some good practices that are existing, and one of the things that we cited here was the wind farms, windmill farms, for instance, that was funded by the prototype carbon fund of the World Bank, where they set up windmills in Jeperachi in Colombia, and they claim that this has helped the indigenous peoples in those communities. We also cited the Western Arnhem Fire Abatement Project in northern territory of Australia, where the indigenous peoples who have been practicing fire abatement have been receiving compensation because their practice has lowered carbon dioxide emissions. So these are just a few of the things that we have seen. We cannot put everything in our report, but no doubt there are lots of adaptation and mitigation measures that indigenous peoples are already doing. But even before that, we also have seen that the struggles of indigenous peoples to stop deforestation from their lands, their struggles to keep the oil and gas from being extracted from their lands, has already contributed gigatons of carbon dioxide emissions out of the atmosphere. So this contribution alone has really significantly achieved mitigation much more than any of the measures that are being taken now. So finally, we went to, just before I go to the recommendations, I wanted to also say some caveat that while the World Bank, for instance, has claimed that the Jeperachi project is a very good practice, I was told by some of the indigenous peoples from Colombia who are from the community that they actually had problems also with this project. So I think those are the kinds of dialogue that we need to undertake, because, of course, if we look at what has been written, some of these are good in paper, but maybe there is some gap in terms of how these are being implemented in practice. So finally, in terms of our recommendations, we have many recommendations. It's actually 4 pages. I won't go through it. But mainly, the recommendation I'd just like to summarize is, first, in any development of climate policies, whether at the national or the global level, we are urging the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Kyoto Protocol, and the international community in general to consider the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, because this is the declaration which defines the right of indigenous peoples to self-determination, their right to free, prior, and informed consent, and therefore any climate change policy that's adopted internationally or nationally should really take this into consideration, especially as this relates, if the project or program that they are doing is very much related to indigenous peoples. Secondly, we are calling on using the human rights-based approach and the ecosystems approach in developing these policies, no? These climate change policies. Thirdly, we are also calling on the Climate Change Convention to develop mechanisms whereby indigenous peoples can effectively participate in the negotiations within the Climate Change Convention, and also in the negotiations leading from Bali to Poland to Copenhagen, no? Because as some of you may know, in 2012, there will already be agreements on the next commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol, which means that the parties to the convention will have to agree on what are the next targets that they have to achieve, no, and how will they achieve this. And we are saying that, of course, as far as indigenous peoples are concerned, there should be higher targets. And these targets are, of course, mainly addressed to the developed countries, because the rich industrialized countries are the ones who have contributed significantly to the greenhouse gas emissions, and therefore they have the bigger responsibility to adopt measures that will lower their greenhouse gas emissions. But we're saying that for this, when the Copenhagen targets are going to be achieved, indigenous peoples have to be actively participating in the process so that their contributions can be integrated in the negotiations. And finally, just to say that the Human Rights Council, which has now an expert mechanism on indigenous peoples, and of course the Permanent Forum, which is mandated to implement the declaration, should really have a very active role in helping analyze the climate change negotiations, but in also helping facilitate the participation of indigenous peoples in these processes. So these are just few recommendations, and maybe I'll just like to end up with one other recommendation, which is not in the document, but this recommendation is that indigenous peoples who have the traditional knowledge in terms of analyzing climate change, who have the science, you know, they understand that they also have their own science in terms of climate change, maybe should be encouraged to develop a report that will contain their traditional knowledge, their analysis, their proposals on how to address climate change. And in 2009, next year, there's going to be a global summit on climate change that indigenous peoples are organizing. And we are hoping that this global summit will really look into all the good practices that indigenous peoples are doing, their traditional knowledge, the mitigation measures that they are taking, because we think that if we are able to consolidate all these practices and ideas, then it will be a very significant contribution to climate change negotiations and to achieving the objectives of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. So those are just few of our recommendations, and Mr. Akaluklingi later on, after Mr. Ahmed Joglaf speaks, will also talk more and focus on the Arctic. So this is just to give you a flavor of what the document contains, but we hope that you will be able to have a chance to read the document, because this will be a document that contains the recommendations that hopefully some of it we will adopt at the end of this session. So with that, I would like to give the floor to Mr. Ahmed Joglaf, the Executive Secretary of the Secretariat of the Convention on Biological Diversity, to also speak to us about the issue of climate change and how it relates with the Convention on Biological Diversity, which he is presently serving as the Executive Secretary. Mr. Ahmed Joglaf, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Vicky, for this fantastic presentation. I believe that is not a flavor that we got, but a full meal. And really, I think that Vicky deserves our applause, because I think she has done a great job through this report, but also through the convening of this meeting, and I think she deserves a big hand for this report. I think this big hand, you deserve it, each of you here, be it indigenous or be it partner, including the UN agencies, because I think you have done a great job since your establishment to promote your issues at the highest level of the political agenda. And I think this meeting is the first being held after the adoption of your historical declaration. So I welcome the 3,000 participants, and through this participation, your success, Vicky, for this achievement. I think this speaks volume about the success of this forum. The declaration contains, I think, a number of provisions which are of a direct relevance to the Convention on Biological Diversity. And therefore, I came here with my colleague, John Scott, to pay tribute for your forum and the promotion of the indigenous and local communities' issues in your agenda. The Convention on Biological Diversity that we love to call Convention on Life on Earth was signed in Rio, first meeting in Nassau in 1994, and since then we are privileged of being the sole UN agency with the full-fledged team to service you, with the full-fledged intergovernmental meeting to service you, and to promote and protect the indigenous and local communities' knowledge and know-how, and to ensure that their right and their traditional knowledge is protected. So any meeting of the Conference of the Parties cannot be held without the contribution of the Article 8J Committee, the exclusively devoted to the protection and promotion of indigenous people. And I am very happy to see that in the audience, a number of faiths are attending both meetings and also attending the Convention on Biological Diversity. As you are aware, I think it's impossible to speak about life on Earth without speaking about nature and our relation with nature. And I think the traditional people, through our ancestors, through millennia, have learned to live in harmony with nature. But lately we have lost our contact with nature, and therefore we start destroying nature. As you know, never in the history of mankind we have destroyed biodiversity as we are doing it from a systematic manner for the last 50 years. And by destroying biodiversity, we are destroying our capital asset. I believe that nature is the biggest company in the world, but also our identity, but also our culture, but also our civilization, and our link with nature. And therefore, I think that biodiversity is beyond just species. It's about life on Earth. And this loss of biodiversity and identity is being compounded by climate change. As you know, IPCC has predicted that 30% of all known species may disappear before the end of this century. And in addition to disappearance of species, culture will disappear. As you know, in each hectare of tropical forest, we may have more than 703 species, so more than, for example, in the United Kingdom. So therefore, and you know, unfortunately, that every second, 20 hectares of forest are being destroyed. Every year, 13 million of hectares are being destroyed. And by destroying this forest, we are destroying 85% of the biodiversity, because 85% of biodiversity is located in tropical forests. By destroying this forest, we are destroying the culture and the people that are living with them and within, in harmony with nature. It is for this reason that Convention on Biological Diversity has celebrated last year the International Day on Biodiversity under the theme Climate Change and Biodiversity. And at that time, the Secretary General has made a statement that you cannot address climate change, that any strategy to adapt to climate change should include biodiversity. Because indeed, climate change is an energy issue. It is a technological issue. It is emission of CO2 and reduction of energy efficiency. But as the chair, Vicky, has said, it is also an environmental issue. Forests are contributing to climate change because 30% of the carbon emitted in the world are absorbed by forests. But deforestation is contributing 20% to the emission of CO2. So it's not only transport, but deforestation is contributing largely. Oceans are a carbon sink, peatland, wetland, but we are destroying them. So therefore, I believe that time has come to address climate change in its real perspective, and its real perspective cannot be addressed without biodiversity. So, Madam Chair, the next meeting of the Conference of the Parties, where we expect more than 5,000 participants, including 120 ministers and heads of states, will address the issue of climate change and biodiversity, and how we need to adapt climate change in all work programs. So we look forward to your report to be submitted to this, because the parties will be discussing options for synergies among the three Rio Convention, climate change, desertification, and biodiversity. And this option the document is on the website. These options are not only for the Secretariat, but also for the government and other stakeholders. So we believe that your report will make a fantastic contribution in ensuring that biodiversity and climate change are being addressed in a mutually supportive manner when it comes both to CBD implementation or CCD. It is for this reason, Madam Chair, that the Secretary General, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, immediately after taking responsibility, has made climate change as one of its highest priorities. This has never happened in the history of the United Nations, and we applaud, therefore, the leadership of our leader, the Chief Administrative Officer of the United Nations, to have climate change as a priority. And climate change, as I said, not only seen from a climate perspective or an energy perspective, but seen in a holistic manner. Madam Chair, the Secretary General also has decided to promote this one UN program. We in the CBD, we are very pleased and honored to be part of this one UN program. But you have an agency that have done it. The Interagency Task Force on the United Nations Forum, comprising 11 agencies, have demonstrated when it comes to indigenous people that they can work together, that they can put their private turf aside and see the big picture, see the forest and not the tree, and they have worked together. So we are extremely pleased in the Secretariat for having hosted the last meeting, the seventh meeting of this interagency task force established in 2002 to prepare your meeting, and I want to pay tribute to the 11 agencies that have contributed to this meeting, but also to the chair, Mr. John Scott, who will present the detail of this report. And I think it's proof also that the United Nations Forum has provided leadership, not only for you, bringing together government, and I am extremely pleased to see that 80 governments have registered, and also pleased to see ministers, like the Minister of Equator, here present, or also mayors here present with you, in addition to the government. I am also very pleased to see the delegation of Australia, comprising more than 45 participants. And I want to pay tribute to the government of Australia for its, I think, historical stand when it comes to indigenous people. And this was recognized when the Conference of the Parties was meeting in Rome for protected area. And this political stand taken by Australia, I think, will go a long way in implementing, in a partnership arrangement, the protected area of the work program, the work program of the CBD on protected area. It will go a long way in implementing all the work programs, including marine, including forest, including agriculture. And I think this is the way to function in the UN. Your forum is a partnership. And I don't think that we will be able to handle the tremendous challenge that we are faced as humankind without a partnership. We need the government, we need the NGOs, we need you as a representative of local indigenous people, we need the local authorities, we need the mayors, we need the parliamentarian, we need the youth, we need the women, we need the private sector, we need the scientific community. So we need to establish what we call in the CBD a global universal alliance for life on earth, and I pay tribute to Germany for hosting the COP9 in Bonn in May with the view of establishing a universal partnership for life on earth, and you are all welcome to join us in Bonn in May 2008. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ahmed Joglaf. Indeed, the Convention on Biological Diversity is really a convention that has allowed for the active participation of indigenous peoples in its processes. And we particularly invited them, not only because they were the chair of the Interagency Support Group meeting, which was held in Montreal, but also because of the good example that the convention has shown. And we would like to see this as a model that can also be done within the Climate Change Convention. I would like to say that we invited the secretariat or members of the parties of the Climate Change Convention, but they have not responded to this. And therefore, we should really come up with some recommendation or ideas on how to ensure that the Climate Change Convention will really open up opportunities for indigenous peoples to actively participate in its processes. Dear colleagues, I would like now to call on Mr. Akaluk Linge, who was mandated together with me to prepare the study on climate change. I now give the floor to Akaluk. You have the floor.
Madam Chair, members of the Permanent Forum, Excellencies, fellow indigenous representatives of the United Nations member states and agencies, ladies and gentlemen. I must say, Madam Chair, that while I take great pleasure in and am deeply honored in addressing this important UN body. I also feel a little nostalgic. As you know, Madam Chair, I spent the past 3 years working closely with you and other members of the United Nations Permanent Forum, and also met many of the thousands of indigenous peoples who have come to the forum sessions and others around the world while conducting our work. I would like to thank you for your guidance as chair over those years, and wish you and the new other members of the forum much success over the next 3 years. I especially wish to thank the new Arctic region member, Mr. Lars Anders Bær, from the Sami Council, who agreed to let his name stand for nomination for this exceptional body, the Permanent Forum members, as well as the Arctic Indigenous peoples, are in capable hands with Mr. Bear's involvement here. I would also like to thank you, Madam Chair, for working with me as a special rapporteur over the past year and investigating how climate change mitigation measures have impacted upon indigenous peoples. We do not have time to report on all aspects of our report, Madam Chair, but I think you would agree that a significant finding that cuts through much of our research, many of our reflections, and most of our recommendations is that indigenous peoples have involved themselves and contributed much to solving the climate change crisis we now find ourselves facing. Indigenous peoples, we have observed, are not going to sit back and simply let others pollute and then also let others try to solve the crisis without our input. We found that indigenous peoples want to contribute, can contribute, and will contribute to solving the climate change challenge. What we also found was that the confronting of the climate change challenge was not as straightforward as we might have thought. In this vein, our report points to successful examples of mitigation, to those that don't work, and those that have been too slow to be enacted, and moreover, those that have been overtly devastating for indigenous peoples. Many of you here in this room have consulted the report, and some of you have conveyed to me even further examples of how you and your communities have been impacted by mitigation measures, and others have told me further stories of successful adaptation measures. Unfortunately, Madam Chair, these stories of success are not numerous enough, not yet. Before focusing exclusively on mitigation measures, the report first outlines the impact of climate change on indigenous peoples. We note that indigenous peoples' lives are affected by increased vector-borne diseases such as malaria caused by rising temperatures. They are affected by increasing drought, forest fires, and loss of biodiversity. They are affected by shoreline erosion, melting permafrost, loss of habitat for animals and plants we harvest, and by new species wreaking havoc on the delicate balance of nature. They are affected by flooding and food insecurity. What makes the impact of climate change even more devastating for indigenous peoples is the second-order effects of some of the mitigation missions themselves. Some are clearly violations of human rights. Lands and territories are taken or used without free, prior, and informed consent. The matter of biofuel production has been spoken about at the Permanent Forum before, and I won't repeat it here. Many other examples exist. And then, as the world community, including that of the United Nations, moved toward addressing the problems of climate change, indigenous peoples, we concluded, have been further marginalized by being left out of many of the processes. These are processes where indigenous peoples are eager to share their knowledge, both traditional and other knowledge that they have developed in partnership with Western-based approaches. Yet, they continue to be shut out. It is perhaps in the redrawing of these relations, many previously built on unequal positions of power, where the most success of mitigating climate change will occur. Another significant finding is that the Arctic plays a central role in the climate change matters. Not only has the Arctic been an early indicator of climate change for the rest of the world, but it is also a region whose melting ice will affect indigenous peoples thousands of kilometers to the south. I am from Greenland, where the ice cap is melting at an unprecedented rate, and where hunters have for years told us something was not right with the climate. They spoke of the migratory patterns of animals that have always changed somewhat, were fluctuating differently over the decade. In a hunter-centered study that the Inuit Circumpolar Council is working on, we hear many stories of new species, thinning ice, disappearing species, and unpredictable weather patterns. In many Alaskan villages, Inuit are experiencing severe shoreline erosion. In connection with that, there's much talk about who owns the Arctic, who has sovereignty over it, and all of this is due to climate change. Oil companies and the shipping industry, Arctic governments and other abroad are all waiting for the North Polar Sea route to open wide. I expect that the old security issues in the Arctic, precipitated by the Cold War, will be soon replaced by new ones. Equally grave, but they will be related to oil spills and arguments over whose land and sea it is. Is it international? Is it domestic? And if it is domestic, whose continental shelf extends further than the other? There are those countries that have already dropped flags recently on the bottom of the sea of the North Pole to say that the Arctic are theirs. Some countries already have drawn lines on maps that are not yet agreed to by its neighbors. There are countries that want to be part of the debate but has not yet ratified the United Nations law on the sea. All this due to climate change. And in all this debate, it is the indigenous peoples of the Arctic who are caught in the middle of it. Isn't it interesting that the burning of fossil fuels is causing the opening of the North Polar Sea, and in turn, as it opens to allow greater access to oil reserves, more burning of fossil fuels is sure to follow. As we call for in the report, an Arctic climate change focal point at the United Nations is important not only for those of us who live there, but for the indigenous world as a whole. As we also point out, much of the difficulty is found in the lack of free, prior, and informed consent. And one who owns the lands and the territories upon which indigenous peoples have sustained themselves for thousands of years. Madam Chair, the joint Greenlandic and Danish Parliamentary Commission on Self-Government have just last week concluded its work, and it recommends that Denmark recognize Greenlanders as a people and to move forward on autonomy talks. This is good news, and I congratulate those here in the room today who helped make that happen. This step forward would lead to many good things, including that of ratifying in both parliaments the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Who knows where the agreement will take us, but I do know that it is through redrawing the relationships formerly based on equal partnership that new and better things ensue. The same can be said for the climate change challenge. I trust the United Nations and its membership will pay heed to our report, and rather than finding ways to avoiding indigenous peoples, it will rely upon their advice and guidance. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Akaluklinge. Before I call on the speakers who are now in the speakers list, I would just like to highlight two more points or three more points which I think should not be missed out in this discussion. First, we are very much aware about the efforts of the World Bank to in establishing their Forest Carbon Partnership Facility, which is a facility that's supposed to develop carbon forests and get this engaged in emissions trading. And many indigenous peoples have critiqued very strongly this facility, especially because its initial stages of being formulated have not involved indigenous peoples at all. And because of the complaint that indigenous peoples have raised, this issue has been tackled within the carbon team of the World Bank, and there has been three consultations in Africa, Asia, and in Latin America on this. And I'm sure the reports of those consultations will come on board at a later stage, and we will see the recommendations that emerge from those, because these are the recommendations that indigenous peoples have developed. The second point I wanted to say is the issue of energy systems. As we know, the one solution to lowering climate carbon dioxide emissions is really to develop a renewable energy systems, and of course the use of alternative fuels which are not coal, oil, or gas. But what we have seen so far is the push towards highly centralized, large-scale alternative or renewable energy systems. And we believe that this is not the solution for climate change, because these systems, number one, are going to be controlled again, not by the indigenous peoples, but by big corporations or even by the state. And indigenous peoples will be outside the fora of deciding what kinds of energy systems there should be. And therefore, the paper also reports that there should be the support for indigenous peoples developing their own small-scale, locally-based and locally-controlled renewable energy systems, because this is what is going to be to work, and this is the more sustainable approach. So this is one of the recommendations. And finally, we pinpointed in paragraph 90 in our report that we are welcoming the proposal of the Greenland Home Rule Government to help facilitate the indigenous people's participation in the Copenhagen Summit. But I think that was a mistake, because we misunderstood that there was that kind of offer, but we haven't really received that officially here in the forum. So it's just maybe a wishful thinking on our part, or a self-fulfilling prophecy that the Greenland Home Rule Government will help facilitate our active participation come Copenhagen Conference of Parties. So just to correct that that number, that paragraph in our report, because it's not, they did not offer officially, so just to clarify that point. Okay, so now we would like to open the speakers list, and as you have seen in your program, this is now going to be a dialogue session with the UN agencies, members of other intergovernmental organizations, and I would like now to call the first person on my list, but I would like to also remind all of you that you have limited speaking time, so please speak within the 5-minute limit. So now I'll call on the Permanent Observer Mission of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources to the United Nations, Mr. Gonzalo Oviedo, the Senior Advisor of the Social Policy and IUCN. Mr. Oviedo, you have the floor.
Gracias, Señora Presidenta.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Allow me to voice to you our pleasure at the fact that you have put on the agenda the very important issue of climate change and its relations with indigenous people. And again, I should like to congratulate you on the excellent introductory document which you presented. In particular, I would like to emphasize how important your proposal is that climate change be examined from the point of view of rights. The fourth evaluation report of the Intergovernmental Expert Group on Climate Change, the IPCC, stated that this would affect the vulnerable peoples of the world to the greatest degree. Indigenous and traditional peoples, in many cases, have been displaced to less fertile land as a result of the historical, social, political, economic exclusion of which they have been victims, dependent on natural resources, and these, to a large extent, are the groups at greatest risk. Today, there is only restricted understanding of the potential impact of climate change on the means of subsistence and cultures of indigenous and traditional communities, as well as the options available to them in order to adapt to climate change. In our studies, endeavoring to contribute to the understanding of this problem, we have concentrated, on the one hand, on endeavoring to identify those areas of the world where there is the highest biocultural degree of risk, in other words, that risk which simultaneously affects ecosystems and the associated cultures. And on the other hand, we have analyzed the factors of ecological and social vulnerability. An examination of the effects of climate change, such as temperature, rainfall, and height above sea level, show important potential impact for indigenous and traditional peoples of certain regions of the world, although forecasting the rates and extent of a change on a regional or local scale in order to determine which groups are most at risk, it still remains a difficult task given the inadequate detail in world and regional models projecting and simulating climate change. It is possible to identify large regions which are likely to experience climate change and extreme weather events. There are areas that have been described. I won't refer to those again. But I would say that the discussions on mitigation and adaptation to climate change still do not pay sufficient attention to vulnerability factors, such as human communities, in particular indigenous peoples. It is absolutely necessary that we learn the lessons from last decades of natural disasters with regard to risk reduction. One of the most important lessons here is that the impacts of natural phenomena occur via social vulnerability factors, and it is important to seek to reduce the risk of these phenomena, to reduce the vulnerability and increase the resistance of communities faced with these disasters. It is very important to analyze how factors of vulnerability, social vulnerability to climate change affect indigenous peoples. If this is not understood, technological solutions may be even more harmful than the very effects of climate change. Vulnerability is a multidimensional concept which includes exposure, sensitivity, and resistance. This concept of vulnerability means that in order to assess the vulnerability of a system to climate change, not just its exposure to biological risk must be considered, but also the effects on vulnerable groups and their abilities to adapt. Specialists consider that the major vulnerability factors are the degree of previous welfare with regard to environmental impact, the degree to which resistance is possible regarding means of subsistence, the ability of groups to protect themselves, and the degree of protection that society can afford, the capital social capital of communities. Indigenous peoples are often in a disadvantaged situation with regard to the first factors, but in many cases they have advantages with regard to their social capital and their knowledge and cultural practices, which can provide a basis for them to adapt and to achieve resistance. If we are to reduce the vulnerability of indigenous peoples to the impacts of climate change, we have to home in on increasing their resistance to the most serious impacts of this. Thus, we have to resolve the problems affecting indigenous peoples with regard to their access to means of subsistence and their social sidelining. We have to enhance their social capital in terms of their knowledge, practices, values, and traditional institutions. Our experience of past natural disasters enables us to see that women of vulnerable community are those who are particularly affected by global warming because of their unequal role in bringing up families, the uncertainty with regard to their rights of property and access to resources, their lack of mobility and periods of stress because of their tasks of looking after children, old people, and the sick. However, experience has shown that because of their role in families, women in vulnerable communities are the most important factor for the reduction of risk and for the adaptation to change. Hence, particular attention should be paid to them. Madam Chairman, the UICN is to start very shortly the implementation of a new program of work where the topic of resistance of such communities to climate change and to natural disasters will be a major priority. This is an issue that will be discussed in the forthcoming World Nature Conference that the UICN will be holding in Barcelona in October this year. I should like to take this opportunity to invite you, the members of the Permanent Forum, the Secretariat staff, and those present to come to the Congress and to join in our discussions in order to press ahead on an agenda which will make it possible to optimize the contributions of the movement to conservation in order to enhance the capacity of resistance of indigenous peoples to climate change. Thank you very much.
I'd like now to call on the representative of the United Nations Development Program, UNDP, Mr. Charles McNeil, the Senior Advisor, the Environment and Energy Group. Mr. McNeil, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. UNDP greatly values the vital contributions that Indigenous peoples and the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues make to human development, and we are honored to have the opportunity to work with you. Indigenous peoples' views and aspirations are the ultimate expression of what the United Nations Development Program and the paradigm of human development are all about. UNDP is well aware that indigenous peoples all over the world are greatly concerned about climate change, not only because they are often disproportionately affected by both the problem of climate change and the world's attempts to address it, as Madam Chair, you have just described, but also because they have so much to contribute to mitigation and adaptation. UNDP recognizes that for many, many decades, and more recently at the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, indigenous elders warned the world community about climate change long before the scientific and political communities had reached consensus on the issue. The disproportionate impacts of climate change on developing countries was the focus of the recent Human Development Report 2007-2008 entitled Fighting Climate Change, Human Solidarity in a Divided World. The report concludes that effective multilateral mechanisms and good governance structures must be developed to address climate change, including respect for the rights of indigenous peoples. UNDP, in its role as convener of the UN system at the country level, will help implement the recently adopted UN Development Group guidelines on indigenous peoples' issues. UNDP will also continue supporting the establishment of participatory and advisory mechanisms as provided in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and in the context of UNDP's new Global Human Rights Strengthening Program. UNDP was honored to receive the visit of the Bureau members of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues just last week, who met with UNDP's administrator, Kamal Dervish, and they discussed how UNDP and indigenous peoples can work hand-in-hand to address the challenges of today, such as climate change and achieving the Millennium Development Goals. But we would also like to hear from many other indigenous peoples and their representatives. To this end, UNDP is undertaking a consultative process with indigenous peoples on the climate change issues of reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation, or RED, related to work UNDP is doing with FAO and UNEP, and also on community-based adaptation. The consultations will begin here at the Permanent Forum and will continue throughout the year to the Biodiversity Convention in May, to the World Conservation Congress in October, and to the Climate Change Convention in December. With regard to climate change adaptation, UNDP has been piloting approaches to community-based adaptation to climate change in 10 countries, and we hope to scale up the current efforts with support from the UN Foundation. We intend to support you in your efforts to make indigenous voices heard more loudly and more clearly than ever on climate change. We fully appreciate the call of indigenous peoples to have stronger participation in national, regional, and international fora on climate change, such as the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Perhaps a goal could be to emulate the practices of the Biodiversity Convention in terms of consultation. The UNDP GEF Small Grants Program is now operational in 102 countries. Approximately 15% of its funding portfolio goes directly to projects submitted by indigenous peoples. In 2008, the Small Grants Program will be collaborating with the recently launched UN Global Program on Human Rights to replicate the experience of the Small Grants Program in promoting participatory video work and oral cultures. Copies of the participatory video, which I have in my hand, made by indigenous participants at the 2006 forum, will be distributed throughout the proceedings here, with additional participatory video facilitation on the theme of climate change made available to participants here in this forum. The UNDP Regional Initiative on Indigenous Peoples' Rights and Development in Asia is now in its second phase and is organizing a series of consultations on natural resources management and cultural sustainability through the lens of climate change and adaptation. A regional dialogue involving more than 100 practitioners and policymakers from 13 countries took place in Chiang Mai, Thailand, last November, organized in partnership with a number of indigenous groups and with support from the Christensen Fund. Community dialogues were also organized last year in Bangladesh and Indonesia, and four more community dialogues are planned for this year and next. The recommendations of these dialogues will inform the global dialogue that will take place here tomorrow, Tuesday, during the lunch break. This year, in the Latin American Caribbean region, UNDP will begin a consultation process with indigenous peoples on how best to implement the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. To conclude, let me just say how greatly and how eagerly we look forward to working with all of you this year and the coming years. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Charles McNeil. And on behalf, again, of the members of the forum, of the Bureau, we would like to thank UNDP for receiving us in the meeting that we held with you last Tuesday. And we hope that this is going to become a regular consultation between the forum and the UNDP. I would like to call now on the representative of the International Telecommunications Union, ITU, Mr. Philip Cross, the ITU Caribbean representative. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, other UN agencies, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I bring you warm greetings from the Secretary General of the International Telecommunication Union, ITU, Dr. Hamadoun Touré, as well as the Director of the Development Bureau, Mr. Sami Al-Bashir. They both send warm greetings and best wishes for a successful meeting. We are pleased to meet here with the distinguished representatives of the indigenous communities and all other stakeholders to provide some ITU views on ICTs and climate change, as well as to give a brief account of some recent ITU initiatives. In terms of information and communication technologies and climate change, the ITU has a mandate which goes back to 1994, and we are constantly being asked to do additional work, which we're happy to do, mainly in providing assistance to countries in the implementation of relevant ICT applications for environment and sustainable development. With respect to our strategy, there are several aspects. I'll just mention one here. And this is to promote a global understanding of the relationship between information and communication technologies and climate change through international meetings and through international agreements. In terms of implementation, all departments of the ITU are involved, and we're working closely with all stakeholders to ensure that this is done. In 2007, the ITU was asked to convene two symposia on information and communication technology and climate change. The first was held last week in Japan, and the next will be held in June in London. For these, the ITU provided several documents, and one of them is called ICT and Climate Change ITU Background Report. And it contains five main areas. The first is climate change and the impact of information and communication technologies. And here it points out that ICTs contribute approximately 2.5% to the total greenhouse gases emitted. The second aspect is the ICT use in monitoring climate change. And here this involves the work related to weather, climate, meteorological aspects, and environmental aspects, and working also with organizations such as the WMO. The third aspect is the mitigating the impact of ICTs and climate change. And what we're saying here, basically, is that one can reduce certain activities, such as travel, paper, energy use, by making better use of information and communication technology. The fourth area concerns the using ICTs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And here, several telephone companies have undertaken studies with other partners to show that this can be done. The fifth area is ICTs for adapting to the local effects of climate change. And here, the ITU has been asked to continue technical studies and support the development of early warning, mitigation, and relief systems. And the ITU has responded in several ways. One is by working with the United Nations Office of the Coordination of Human Affairs, OCHA, and providing them with a special number for use in disaster relief activities. Second area has been the convening of an ITU global forum on the effective use of telecommunications and ICTs for disaster management. And this was aimed at adopting concrete measures aimed at giving ICTs a central role in all phases of disaster management, early warning, preparedness, relief, and response. With respect to the implications for developing countries, for indigenous communities, we know there are serious implications, and different countries will adapt differently. And the capacity to adapt and mitigate depends on socioeconomic and environmental circumstances, as well as the availability of information and communication technologies. And we know that these are limited in certain areas. In order to deal with this, there are several recommendations that one could make. And here I'll just mention one thing, and that there is a strong need to assign the environment a more important profile in strategic planning initiatives at the national level, and in particular in e-government initiatives, so that the use of ICTs for the environment is integrated into planning processes from the beginning, along with other national priorities and initiatives. And this would include aspects such as the disposal of ICT equipment, because this can be quite a burden on the environment. With respect to our engagement with the indigenous communities, the ITU has a special initiative on indigenous peoples and communities, and we convened in 2005 the first regional workshop on indigenous issues, which was organized by the ITU and the Government of Mexico. And the objectives focus on the definition of a general vision of the indigenous people of the Americas region in respect of ICTs, the identification of priorities and common needs in ICTs, foundations for the creation of an indigenous regional portal for the development and self-sustainability of these communities through information and communication technologies, and the creation of ICT opportunities through a process of interchanging experiences. As a result of that, the ITU now is now in the process of developing the Americas Regional Portal for Indigenous People as a first phase within the framework of a global portal for Indigenous people. Later this year, we will be having another workshop in Brazil, and that is now being planned. In addition, we have established two telecenters in Honduras and Brazil, and these have been established for the benefit of indigenous communities of the Americas region, and we are in the process of planning two others. Madam Chair, that is the extent of my presentation, and the ITU is happy to work with all stakeholders in relation to matters related to the information and communication technology and ICTs, as well as providing assistance to the indigenous community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cross. This is the first time that we got the ITU to come and participate in the session of the Permanent Forum, so I wish this will be a regular participation from here on. I think the contributions you gave are going to be crucial for Indigenous people's works on climate change, among others. I'd like to call now on the United Nations Population Fund, Ms. Sonia Martinelli-Hecadon, the Senior Program Advisor, Latin American and Caribbean Division. You have the floor, Madam.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, distinguished members of the forum, distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen. UNFPA, the United Nations Population Fund, wants to express its gratitude for the one-day meeting in 2007 with members of the forum, including the chair and the secretariat, which was organized to discuss with UNFPA's senior management strategies to improve UNFPA's work in favor of indigenous peoples at all levels of the organization. No doubt this dialogue has contributed to enhance UNFPA's engagement with indigenous issues, particularly indigenous women and youth, as reflected in its recently approved strategic plan 2008-2011, which commits itself in line with the approved UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples to reduce social and economic gaps among excluded populations, including indigenous people and other ethnic minorities, and to continue adopting culturally sensitive approaches to ensure ownership of human rights, including gender equality and the empowerment of women and reproductive rights. We are pleased to report that UNFPA's work on indigenous issues has been expanded in Latin America at both regional and country level. At the regional level, UNFPA elaborated its strategic note to provide increased guidance to its country offices and partners working on indigenous issues. Of particular importance has been its continued partnership at the regional level with the Enlace Continental de Mujeres Indígenas de las Américas, promoting their empowerment and strengthening, as well, its continued partnership with ECLAC, Population Division CELADE, which has been key in assisting data collection, including on migration and indigenous peoples in urban areas. With sister agencies, we have recently been participating in the preparation of a proposal for the dissemination of the Declaration of Human Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the training of indigenous peoples, including indigenous women leaders, in this proposal. In response to the forum's recommendations, as well as government priorities and the priorities of indigenous people, UNFPA has concentrated its efforts in the incorporation of indigenous issues in the formulation of sector policies, particularly the incorporation of indigenous worldviews on reproductive health policies, programs, and norms, the integration of human rights, particularly reproductive health rights, in programs, and the mainstreaming of indigenous women and youth special needs and concerns. During 2007, UNFPA has continued advancing its work on the development and implementation of intercultural reproductive health models, programs and strategies in countries such as Bolivia, Panama, Mexico, Ecuador, Laos, Vietnam, and others, supporting joint community-based and government initiatives for building capacities to improve access to culturally acceptable, high-quality reproductive health services, addressing the high maternal mortality indicators and equity gaps which still prevail among indigenous women in all geographic regions. Also, UNFPA programs have addressed issues regarding the prevention of harmful practices and the dissemination of HIV/AIDS among indigenous people, for which important research and evidence-based studies have been carried out. Added to this experience in some countries such as Ecuador and Mexico, UNFPA has continued to support the development of models on sexual and reproductive health for indigenous youth, including indigenous migrant youth, which are being upskilled through their incorporation in subnational policies, programs, and budgets. In the realm of population and development, UNFPA has continued to promote the importance of data collection to address the needs and human rights and concerns of indigenous peoples by supporting the generation, analysis, use, and dissemination of data on indigenous peoples in some countries, and by supporting efforts to integrate indigenous information in the 2010 round of population and housing censuses. You will find the complete information in this report that UNFPA has submitted to the forum. Madam Chair, concerning the special topic of this session, the international community has serious, far-reaching challenges to address to help countries consider the needs of indigenous peoples in regard to climate change, water, food, habitat destruction, traditional knowledge and resources, and their relationship with the environmental impact and climate change, including the effects on health. UNFPA believes that environmental concerns of indigenous peoples, including the impact of climate change, should be mainstreamed into development activities and incorporated in population, economic, health, energy, and agricultural policies, but also in gender policies. Enhanced regional collaboration is particularly important since many environmental challenges affect indigenous communities living cross borders in several countries, sub-regions, or entire regions. UNFPA addresses issues related to population, poverty, and the environment, including climate change, through various measures, including, first, policy dialogue. UNFPA supports policy dialogue and partnerships at all levels to promote policies that address the linkages among population dynamics, resource use, and environmental management. Second, through capacity building, UNFPA works on strengthening institutional capacity at the national level to ensure a better understanding of the linkages among population, poverty, and the environment. Third, through advocacy, UNFPA supports advocacy work that reaches out to different government and non-government actors and draws attention to the population, poverty, and environmental nexus. It supports public awareness and education on the importance of environmental sustainability and preservation of indigenous lands, resources, and traditions. Fourth, through data collection and research, The fund supports and will continue to support activities that promote the collection, analysis, and greater use of data for informed environmental decision and planning, including for urban planning, particularly at local and district level, and detailed mapping of population and environmental interactions. Through these strategic interventions, UNFPA assists countries to better position themselves in addressing population issues such as environmental ones in development and poverty eradication frameworks, contributing to mitigate the negative effects of climate change and other environmental issues on the most excluded sectors of the population, including indigenous peoples and women. Madam Chair, distinguished members of the forum, we want to reiterate once again UNFPA's commitment to work with our traditional partners, governments, civil society, indigenous, global, regional, and community-based organizations to improve the human rights situation, including reproductive rights and gender rights of indigenous people and women throughout the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The representative of UNFPA, Ms. Sonia Martinelli Hicadon. I would just like to alert my colleagues in the forum that after UNICEF has spoken, I will open the floor and give the floor to you if you would like to ask questions from the members of the agencies who have spoken so far. So you can prepare questions or comments that you would like to make, a few of you would like to make, so we can have some kind of dialogue. I'd like now to call on the representative of the International Labour Organization, Mr. Janko Njonko, representative to the United Nations and director, ILO Office for the United Nations. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the sake of time, as requested, a longer version of my statement has been made available to the delegates. We thank you very much for providing the ILO with the opportunity to speak under this important agenda item on climate change, which, after a number of years of fading political and public attention, now serves to remind the world of the perils of ignoring global warming. Developing countries have historically contributed the least to emissions causing climate change, but stand to suffer more because they are more vulnerable and least able to adapt. Today, we have seen in the report by the special rapporteurs how this is critical to the world's indigenous people who are disproportionately affected by climate change, among other things, by greater exposure to diseases in tropical and subtropical areas, worsening drought conditions, food insecurity, and loss of ancestral lands. The situation is all the more unjust because the 370 million indigenous people throughout the world, through their lifestyles based on sustainable production systems or their traditional occupations, contribute the least to climate change. In fact, many indigenous people practice a carbon-negative lifestyle conducive to mitigation. The ILO's Green Job Initiative focuses on incorporating employment and income generating into the climate change discourse. The Green Jobs Initiative focuses on investing in people and their skills. For example, small-scale renewable energy projects in rural areas could contribute to generating power for many indigenous people in the world who currently do not have access to modern forms of energy. This would be a major boost for development and poverty reduction through green jobs. Climate change is closely linked to the ILO mandate and its program of work, including the promotion of international labor standards. ILO Convention No. 111, for example, provides an important framework for the promotion of the rights of indigenous women and men to equality and decent work. This is consistent with the Indigenous and Tribal Peoples Convention 1989, No. 169, and the 2007 United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Indigenous people's equal access to decent work that respects their needs and aspirations is not only a matter of human rights, it is crucial to the attainment of international and national development objectives. Madam Chair, decision makers are often unaware of the importance of indigenous people's traditional occupations in the pursuit of poverty reduction, food security, and sustainable development, as well as for the national economy in general. Traditional occupations are often unjustly disregarded as being outdated or unproductive, and are even in some cases prohibited by law. This is further aggravated by the deterioration of the environment, of environmental conditions, lack of investment, infrastructure and social services where indigenous peoples live, and as well as poor access to market and credit. The result is malnutrition, low educational levels, health problems, increasing poverty, unemployment and underemployment, widespread out-migration from indigenous lands, and the destruction of social fabric and cultural institutions. The ILO welcomes the adoption of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and its complementarity to ILO Convention No. 111 and No. 169. However, recent ILO research on the inclusion of indigenous peoples in poverty reduction strategy show the hindrances and challenges in realizing these rights. In this regard, UN agencies, governments, indigenous peoples and development partners must use the momentum generated to close the implementation gap by initiating practical and coordinated long-term implementation processes at the national level. The Interagency Support Group on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, during its recent special meeting in Geneva, expressed its commitment to work in a coordinated fashion to address the implementation gap. The interagency group affirmed the complementarity and mutually reinforcing nature of the UN Declaration and the ILO Convention No. 169, acknowledging that this should provide for a renewed momentum for ratification of Convention 169 and underlining the importance of the legally binding character of the convention and its institutionalized supervisory mechanism. The recent development of the guidelines for UN country teams on indigenous issues is an important step forward. Equally encouraging is the example of Nepal, with the ratification of ILO Convention No. 169 and the steps already taken towards implementation through the establishment of a national task force. This process shows the potential of utilizing the recognition of indigenous peoples' rights as a framework for building inclusive societies. Madam Chair, the way forward is clear for the international community and governments in the response to mitigating climate change, and indigenous people must be included as partners to support the integration of the economic, social, and environmental pillars of sustainable development. The potential for creating decent work is enormous for indigenous people, but experience teaches us that it is not realized automatically. The ILO stands ready to continue to contribute to the efforts and supports fully the recommendation by the special rapporteurs. I thank you very much for giving us the floor, Madam Chairperson.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the representative of ILO, especially for the support that they are giving to the recommendations from the report that we have made. Also, the reminding us about a convention, Convention 111, which I think is very significant for indigenous peoples, because we say that our traditional occupations are really very much undermined by the dominant system, but these have still existed because of the persistence of indigenous peoples. Now I'd like to call on the representative of the United Nations Children's Fund, Ms. Nadine Perot, the human rights specialist. You have the floor, Madam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, Indigenous representatives, delegates, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, UNICEF would like to take this opportunity to once again welcome the adoption of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Just 1 month following the adoption of the declaration, UNICEF Regional Office for the Americas and the Caribbean, along with the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum and the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, with the support of the government of Spain, organized an important meeting between indigenous leaders and all UN agency focal points to discuss the declaration and coordinate follow-up mechanisms and dissemination plans. UNICEF in particular welcomes that the declaration include a specific non-discrimination provision on indigenous children, strong provision on their right to education and linguistic rights, as well as on the protection of indigenous children from economic exploitation and their special needs, particularly in regard to improving their social condition. Using the declaration together with the Convention on the Rights of the Child will bring comparative strength to the overall promotion and protection of the rights of indigenous children. All of these issues are of particular importance to UNICEF. Education is, for example, an important area of UNICEF programming for indigenous peoples in many countries. From West and Central Africa to Latin America, UNICEF advocates for the rights of indigenous children from an intercultural perspective and supports education programs that take into account their traditional knowledge. The linguistic rights of indigenous children are also important to UNICEF work. In line with the Convention on the Rights of the Child, UNICEF has been promoting the use of indigenous languages in education and in other sectors which are linked to the integral development of indigenous children and women. UNICEF, along with other institutions, has supported the translation and printing of the declaration into 16 indigenous languages and has been using several indigenous languages in communication materials and in supporting governments in improving education, health, and protection service delivery. We have also been strongly advocating, along with the Organization of American States and international NGOs, for the use of indigenous languages in birth registration documents. UNICEF is convinced that the use of indigenous languages is not only a strategy for improving social services, it is a right of indigenous people. It is also a key strategy for the empowerment of indigenous peoples, particularly women and girls. In line with the Declaration and ILO Convention 169, UNICEF also considers the involvement of indigenous people in decision-making regarding programs and policies that affect them to be very important. UNICEF has been promoting several indigenous leaders' consultative groups for the UN at the country level. Our experience with the regional consultative group for our office in Latin America and the Caribbean has been acknowledged by others, and with the joint leadership of UNICEF and OSCHR, this consultative group may soon become a reference mechanism for all UN agencies in the region. Madam Chair, this year, we are discussing the stewardship role of indigenous peoples, as well as new challenges in regard to climate change, biocultural diversity, and livelihoods. International concerns have been growing on the impact of climate change on the earth. With its dramatic and harmful effects on the environment, climate change threatens the basic elements of life for people throughout the world, harming health and the environment and limiting access to water, food, and land. As such, it will potentially make every one of the Millennium Development Goals less achievable, slowing efforts to eradicate poverty, improve health, and protect the environment. Climate change has a particularly serious impact on indigenous peoples whose way of life is closely linked to their relationship with their lands and natural resources. However, the effects of this mounting crisis on indigenous children have so far not been fully addressed. UNICEF is increasingly concerned about the impact of climate change on indigenous children. The implications of climate change on the health and development of indigenous children are significant. Another consequence is the increased vulnerability of indigenous children to labor and economic exploitation and to dropping out of school. Furthermore, the breakdown of indigenous structures due to climate change puts indigenous children at particular risk. Sadly, climate change is likely to affect their way of life, resulting in a loss of their cultural identity and traditional knowledge. It is thus vital to address children's and environmental issues, both in terms of the impact of the environment on indigenous children's survival, growth, and development, and in terms of the important roles indigenous children can play as agents for change. Recognizing the importance of indigenous knowledge is an important factor to determining ways in which to address climate change and restore and preserve the environment. Madam Chair, almost any action taken to enhance environmental quality also helps to meet the basic rights of indigenous children. UNICEF is increasingly raising awareness on the impact of climate change on children. During the third meeting of the parties to the Kyoto Protocol in Bali, UNICEF held a side event on climate change and children to highlight the special vulnerability of children to climate change-related effects and the unique capacity of children and young people to adapt and lead meaningful change at community levels. Finally, it should be mentioned that several UNICEF country offices are working on environmental issues with indigenous people. This is the case, for example, in Brazil, in Bolivia, and other countries. UNICEF is also fully engaged with UN partners, including the World Food Programme and the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, in developing a cohesive and coordinated UN response to escalating food prices and in ensuring that the needs of children and women are met as part of that response. In particular, UNICEF is focused on possible increases in severe acute malnutrition and on the impact of climate change on other programs that are essential to children's welfare. UNICEF is also working to strengthen early warning and preparedness system to respond quickly where children are at most at risk. Madam Chair, members of the Permanent Forum, we look forward to continuing working with you to protect indigenous children from the negative impact of climate change on their survival, growth, and development, and to also support further work on the positive opportunities for indigenous children to make a valuable contribution to national and international platforms and frameworks as valuable stakeholders and agents for change. Thank you.
Very much. I'd like now to give a chance to my distinguished colleagues if there are any of you who would like to raise questions or make comments at this point before I proceed to call the remaining speakers on the list. So is there anybody who would like to say something or ask a question? Yes, my distinguished colleague Elisa Canquimolo from Bolivia. You have the floor.
Gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I listened carefully to the reports from the various institutions which are part and parcel of the system. But my concern is this. What is happening at a local level? We're seeing many of these changes occurring at the level of the leading offices in the system. But if you knock on the door of somebody in a particular country and you want to talk to a specialist, say from UNICEF, UNDP, or other programs, very little seems to be said about indigenous peoples and what we hear about at leadership level. So I would ask, it still remains a challenge to make headway on these initiatives. Can we not ensure that things filter down to those at grassroots level so that it is possible to heed the demands from the indigenous peoples there? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will not get the answers to those questions yet. We'll just gather a number of comments and questions, and then later on we'll come back to the agencies. Is there any other comment from
Musangi,
my...
Musangi.
Yes, Lilian Musangi Imbela, you have the floor. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me thank all the speakers of this morning and this afternoon, and I particularly would like to commend the presence of the Bolivian President here this morning among us. I would also like to commend my former colleague, Akaluk, and welcome him with respect to and commend him for respect to his report and your joint report in addition. I have a small comment, a small suggestion to make with respect to UNICEF. I'm from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, that is the very center of Africa. This is a region that for two decades has been in ongoing war and conflict. As you know, in these regions, there is a widespread use militarily of children, and specifically indigenous children. I would suggest that UNICEF give greater attention to this area, and more specifically, would suggest that they give great attention to the use of children soldiers from indigenous groups, because in this area there is a quite disturbing situation. More effective action would help us to address this situation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, my distinguished colleague from the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'd like now to call on Margaret Lokawa, my colleague from Uganda. You have the floor, Margaret.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank the current speakers, especially the UN agencies, for having given us their report. I have been listening keenly, and I was touched with the report of UNPA, where it deals with women and children and youth specifically. My concern or request to them is, I'm wondering why they are dealing only with Latin America. I have not heard anything about Africa. And yet when we looked at the poverty indices, actually women face a lot of problems. And it would be my wish and request that they extend the same programs to Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Margaret Lokawa. I'd now like to call on my colleague Pavel Solyansiga from the Russian Federation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to express my gratitude to you and to Mr. Junku for the very well-prepared document that we have, and also express my gratitude to the UN agencies that have presented reports and briefed us today. I have a question, my initial question, which may be more of a general strategic question to all UN agencies. Are there any plans in existence among UN agencies with respect to implementation of the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples that was adopted by the General Assembly? We all know clearly that Paragraph 42 gives clear instructions to the agencies via the forum to step up their efforts to implement this declaration. And I also have questions for UNDP. UNDP is perhaps the major UN agency that has to do with development, including resources and with respect to capacities in this area. And I would like to And we already discussed this in our meetings with UNDP. I would like to once again raise the issue that, but first of all, I would say that I am grateful with respect to the staff member who is a focal point for work with indigenous peoples, but that person also addresses other issues as well beyond indigenous issues. And take into account the experience, the rather sad experience we had in our country when indigenous peoples are apparently dealt with by varying agencies, and what happens is that no one deals with them. We have questions and suggestions for UNDP and other agencies. Maybe they could look at this issue. That is, to have special people, ad hoc people that deal only in their agencies, such as UNDP, with the indigenous peoples. At each session, we talk about the issues of poverty, issues of the environment, etc., and so on. But all those issues have to do with all peoples, of course, but specifically with indigenous peoples. And until unless we have a more focused work effort with in the agencies with indigenous peoples, then this will go on and on. And we will not achieve any success. There will be many documents issued. A host of papers will come out, but there will be no outcomes on this. And something for UNICEF, I would have a request, because UNICEF is working in the Russian Federation. However, our attempt to work out UNICEF cooperation with UNICEF ended up with us being told that UNICEF cooperates with the government and all questions should go through the government. My question then is that UNICEF maybe could hold trainings with its people in the Russian office and tell them about the laws that exist in the UN, the regulations in the UN, including with respect to how UN works with indigenous peoples, so that they would not violate their own charters and their own documents. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pavel Sulianciga. I'll not. Can I just proceed first with the list, because I'd like to finish with the list now, and then I'll come back to those who were asked questions and also to my colleagues for the second round. So I'd like now to move on to the next speaker on my list. Please take note of the questions that were addressed to you, because I'll come back to you later. I'd like to call on the representative of the United Nations International Strategy for Disaster Reduction, Ms. Paula Uski, on behalf of Mr. Salvanio Briseño, the director of ISDR. You have the floor, Madam.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Honorable delegates, ladies and gentlemen, let me summarize the ISDR statement available at the back of the room, and thank you for this opportunity. The use of local knowledge, innovation, and education to build a culture of safety and resilience at all levels is recognized by the Hyeokgo Framework for Action, building the resilience of nations and communities to disasters as a key priority. People should be encouraged and enabled to take action to reduce risks and build resilience to disasters by adopting and translating relevant traditional knowledge and successful practices into action. Culturally accessible communication and people-centered early warning systems that reach out to rural and indigenous groups in their local language are an effective way of raising community awareness and engagement. The success story from Similu Island off the coast of Sumatra is a perfect illustration of the most effective contribution of traditional knowledge to saving lives. Whilst in the ASEC mainland, more than 100,000 people were killed by the Indian Ocean tsunami, only 7 people out of the island's 100,000 population lost their lives thanks to the transmission of their local knowledge of earthquakes and early warning signals of natural hazards from one generation to the other. Thailand's Mokan tribe in Surin Island had a similar experience in the tsunami when elders called for a hilltop evacuation when they observed the sea rapidly receding.
Excuse me, can you just stop for a while? I think there's a problem with the Spanish translation. Is it okay now? All right? Can you... Is the Spanish translation working now? It's okay. Okay. Please present. Sorry.
A Thailand Smokan tribe in Surin Island had a similar experience in the tsunami when elders called for a hilltop evacuation when they observed the sea rapidly receding before the tsunami hit. Indigenous knowledge represents a huge potential for disaster risk reduction. It is important not only identify and recognize the traditional and indigenous knowledge bases, such as soil conservation, rainwater harvesting, and reading nature's early warning signals as early warning mechanisms, but also strengthen and transfer them for further replication and wider use in communities sharing similar natural threats and hazards before this invaluable knowledge is lost, in particular by the rapidly increasing urban growth. Indigenous communities are among the first to face the impacts of climate change, and any changes to the ecosystem may affect their way of life and survival. It is urgent to build adaptation responses into planning and to scale up the use of existing tools provided by the ISDS system, including local and indigenous ones, and to adapt to climate change and reduce disaster risk. Indigenous peoples' harmonious relations with nature and their environment, as well as their related knowledge of mountain or coastal ecosystems, river basin management, drought mitigation, housing, and sophisticated traditional knowledge of weather patterns, including complex adaptive responses towards cycles of climatic variability, places them in a leading position in terms of guiding world communities towards climate change adaptation practices. We all have a lot to learn from indigenous practices and knowledge, as well as from their sensitivity to nature and animal behaviors to enhance our capacity to anticipate disasters and to adapt to changing rules in nature linked to climate variabilities. Madam Chair, it is therefore absolutely crucial to combine and balance indigenous knowledge and modern scientific information and to mainstream indigenous practices and expertise into climate change adaptation for mutual benefit. It is in that spirit that the UNISDR Secretariat, in partnership with Kyoto University and UNESCO, is promoting the use and recognition of indigenous knowledge for disaster risk reduction. As one example, a regional workshop on indigenous knowledge for disaster risk reduction is planned for the fall 2008 in Thailand, and you are certainly invited to share your good practices and participate there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The representative of the United Nations International Strategy for Disaster Reduction. Again, this is the first time that we were able to get a participation from your institution, so I welcome your participation, and I think the whole issue of disaster reduction is indeed most relevant to the issue at hand that we are taking up. I'd like now to call on the representative of the United Nations Human Settlements Program, UN Habitat, Ms. Helen Anderson, the alternate focal point on indigenous issues. You have the floor, Madam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, Indigenous representatives, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Urbanization is occurring at an ever-increasing pace, and in the near future, over half of the world's total population will be urban. Cities are in general seen to be engines of economic, social, and cultural development, but they can also generate and intensify social exclusion of disadvantaged and marginalized groups, including indigenous peoples. Although the majority of the world's indigenous peoples currently live in rural areas, there is a rapid urbanization process occurring, fueled by many factors, including land dispossession, displacement, conflict, and increasingly, climate change effects on ancestral lands and traditional livelihoods. UN Habitat works towards the goal of adequate shelter for all and sustainable human settlements development, while focusing on the needs of the poor and other vulnerable and disadvantaged groups, including indigenous peoples. The Habitat Agenda, Millennium Development Goals, and other relevant international instruments and frameworks related to spatial, economic, and social development, as well as human rights, provide guidance to UN Habitat's work. In response to the outcome and recommendations from the fourth and fifth permanent forum sessions, UN Habitat, in cooperation with the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, the International Organization for Migration, and the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, organized an international expert group meeting on urban indigenous peoples and migration in Santiago de Chile in March 2007. The report of this expert group meeting was submitted to the sixth session of the Permanent Forum, and it contained recommendations to UN agencies and stakeholders. One of these recommendations calls on UN Habitat and the co-organizing agencies of the expert group meeting to facilitate the elaboration of policy guidelines for governments and local authorities to assist in the development of public policies related to the challenges faced by indigenous peoples in urban in cities. UN Habitat, under the umbrella of the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Issues, has begun implementation of this recommendation. The first in a series of policy guides will be on urban indigenous peoples' housing. This guide is expected to contribute to the more effective realization of indigenous peoples' housing rights and secure tenure in the urban setting, thus complementing the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, as well as the United Nations Development Group guidelines on indigenous peoples' issues. Facilitated by the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Issues, consultations on the implementation of this recommendation will be held during this first week of the Permanent Forum and will take into account the Permanent Forum's thematic focus on climate change mitigation and adaptation. The outcomes of these consultations will be presented to the Forum under Agenda Item 8, under Ongoing Priorities and Themes on Urban Indigenous Peoples and Migration, during the morning session on the 30th of April. UN Habitat has several policy instruments and program activities that are relevant to indigenous peoples and climate change challenges and mitigation. UN Habitat's new global campaign for sustainable urbanization and the advocacy work of the recently established Sustainable Urban Development Network focus on urban governance, decentralization, and environmental issues, looking at how climate change impacts human settlements and how to adapt cities and local governments with the participation of civil society to be more responsive to climate challenges. Particular concerns here are impacts of climate change on livelihoods, affecting, for example, agriculture and pastoral lands, as well as direct physical effects on buildings and infrastructure in affected areas, for example, due to increased flooding. The resolution from the 21st session of the Governing Council of UN Habitat on sustainable development of Arctic human settlements particularly mandates UN Habitat to work on climate change challenges faced by indigenous peoples in that region. Articles 21 and 23 of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples are of particular importance to UN Habitat's work and mandate as regards housing-related issues. Adequate housing for all requires planning for equal access to land and basic services, which can only be delivered through inclusive participatory urban governance that respects the right of indigenous peoples to fully participate in all relevant decision-making processes. UN Habitat, through its work as focal point in the UN system for working with local authorities, promotes the principles of inclusiveness and equity in urban governance and participatory planning for human settlements development. Several of UN Habitat's ongoing activities also contribute to the five main objectives of the second international decade of the world's indigenous peoples. These activities include economic and social empowerment of indigenous peoples, urban economic development and finance, looking at rural-urban linkages, promoting civic engagement, social integration, participatory urban planning and management, and gender mainstreaming. We are also engaged with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in the development of a global monitoring mechanism for progress on the realization of the right to adequate housing based on a set of housing rights indicators. Indigenous peoples' issues will also feature prominently in the upcoming World Urban Forum, which will take place from the 2nd to 7th November this year in Nanjing, China. UN Habitat looks forward to engaging further on the crucial issue of the role of indigenous peoples in the process of mitigation and adaptation to climate change through this permanent forum session. And we also look forward to your participation in the fourth session of the World Urban Forum. Thank you very much.
À présent, j'appelle Madame.
I now give the floor to Ms. Juanita Castaño from UNEP to take the floor. You have the floor.
Buenas tardes.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished representatives of indigenous peoples, members of the Permanent Forum, dear colleagues and friends. I wish to greet you very warmly and apologize to you because I shall continue in English.
It's my honor to address the Permanent Forum at this historic session of the Forum after the adoption of the Declaration of Indigenous Peoples' Rights. Climate change is high on every agency's and many governments' agendas. UNEP adopted at its last special session of the Governing Council held in February this year a medium-term strategy for the years 2010-2013 and identified climate change as one of six thematic priorities for the focus of its efforts. The other thematic priorities are disasters and conflict, ecosystem management, environmental governance, harmful substances and hazardous waste, as well as resource efficiency, sustainable consumption, and production. All these themes are also of utmost importance to the indigenous peoples. UNEP has more than 20 years of experience with various aspects of climate change as a global environmental issue and is well positioned to support to a greater extent moves by governments, the private sector, and civil society to reduce the emission of greenhouse gases and to adequately prepare for the consequences resulting from change climate. A climate change strategy has been developed which provides the foundation for transforming the organization's engagement on climate change and for the developing as a results-oriented program of work that contributes to the Secretary General's decision that climate change is one of the three highest priorities for the UN system. People in affected regions must have their voices heard in the adaptation and mitigation discussions at local, regional, and international levels. UNEP plays a significant role in catalyzing action to protect the environment through collaboration with a multitude of major groups, actors who share the same purpose. UNEP's strategy on enhancing major groups' engagement is based on engagement at the policy level to take into account major groups' expertise and views at the intergovernmental level and on the programmatic level in implementation of UNEP's work program. The Executive Director recently endorsed the new guidelines for improving the global civil society cycle, which reinforces the major groups' approach, which enables to capture specific groups' priorities and concerns. Indigenous peoples also do have a representative elected for 2 years on the Major Groups Facilitating Committee coming from the ICC Inuit Circumpolar Council, Canada. To address environmental concerns in an adequate manner, the participation of civil society organizations and Indigenous peoples' organizations is required, especially in the intergovernmental decision-making process during which UNEP develops its operational policies and work program. Accreditation will grant the organization a consultative status at UNEP within the rules of procedure of the UNEP Governing Council Global Ministerial Environmental Forum. Please do contact UNEP for any information on the accreditation process. To get indigenous peoples' voices heard, they have to be present and participate effectively alongside other major groups and civil society representatives. UNEP believes civil society and indigenous peoples' organizations' views are essential in international environmental governance. UNEP will especially like to bring to the notice of the Permanent Forum the work it has initiated following a recommendation to UNEP from the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in 2006 to develop a specific policy on indigenous peoples. This important task is well underway, and a first draft has been discussed with indigenous peoples' representatives during the UNFCCC COP13 in Bali in December 2007 and was undergoing a wider electronic consultation in January and February 2008. UNEP decided to extend the consultation process during this permanent forum session on the draft in order to have more indigenous voices heard regarding their priorities and needs in the context of environment. UNEP and TEPTEBA are therefore reorganizing an additional public consultation this coming Wednesday at 6 p.m. in the Drew Room in the basement of the Church Center. I do hope that indigenous peoples, especially from America, will be able to attend and share their ideas, thoughts, and needs with us. Thank you for your attention.
I now give the floor to Ms. Tricia Riedi from UNITAR, and I give her the floor.
Thank you. The Program in Peacemaking and Preventive Diplomacy of the United Nations Institute for Training and Research originated in 1993 in response to an expressed need within the UN system for training in modern techniques of negotiation and mediation. UNITAR has been conducting training for mid- and senior-level government officials from around the world and United Nations staff on peacemaking and conflict prevention since 1993, and for indigenous representatives since 2000. The UNITAR training program to enhance the conflict prevention and peace-building capacities of indigenous peoples' representatives was developed based on the request of indigenous peoples' representatives from around the world at consultations in Geneva and on the recommendations of UN special rapporteurs to provide advanced training in conflict analysis and negotiation to representatives of indigenous peoples. More than 330 indigenous peoples' representatives from around the world have been trained in 6 international programs and 5 regional training programs, including the most recent program organized in the Pacific region, where over 50% of participants were indigenous women. Regional trainings have been organized to date in Mexico, Thailand, Tanzania, Morocco, and Australia. The main objectives of the UNITAR training programs on conflict prevention and peace building are to strengthen participants' capacities to analyze conflict, to identify the needs, fears, concerns, and aspirations of all parties to a conflict, and based upon this, and engage in dialogue with partners to formulate mutually beneficial and sustainable options to address problems. The focus is on the process of analyzing and dealing with conflict in a constructive manner. With strengthened tools of conflict analysis, negotiation, and relationship building, Indigenous representatives are further equipped to engage in dialogue on issues to address the priorities of their communities and to improve the lives of their peoples. The training aims to strengthen Indigenous representatives' ability to negotiate all of the areas under the mandate of the Permanent Forum: environment, health, education, culture, economic and social development, and human rights. In his address to the third session of the Permanent Forum, former Secretary General Kofi Annan stated that if the 21st century is to be the age of prevention, Indigenous peoples must be actively involved in decisions that affect them. As marginalization and exclusion from political and economic processes lead to alienation and poverty and constitute some of the root causes of conflict, and we heard this morning also from the current Secretary General, then enhancing capacity and opportunities for the meaningful participation of Indigenous women and men in decision-making and political and developmental processes comprise some concrete mechanisms for the prevention of violent conflict. Inclusive, consultative approaches also enhance understanding of the needs, perspectives, experiences, and diverse cultures of Indigenous peoples, which can assist in the formulation of appropriate policies and programs that best address their respective needs in a sustainable manner. The UNITAR training focuses on strengthening negotiation skills so that Indigenous peoples may more effectively negotiate in development, environment, and other processes that affect their peoples. senior indigenous experts who serve as resource persons for the UNITAR training programs present case studies on conflict and negotiation processes on development and resource and environmental issues, as these are key conflictual areas indigenous peoples and states face. UN special rapporteurs are also invited to address the group. Dr. Rodolfo Stevenhagen, the current Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples, addressed the Regional Training for Indigenous Peoples of the Americas held in Mexico, and his annual reports have been disseminated at each subsequent training. The incoming Special Rapporteur, Professor Jim Anaya, has served as a key resource person for all six UNITAR international trainings and each of the five regional training programs, presenting international human rights mechanisms and UN and regional processes for dialogue and the promotion and protection of rights. The program also examines mechanisms and processes that look at the program also examines mechanisms and processes that promote participation of diverse groups in order to counter marginalization and exclusion. Participants then engage in negotiation simulations focusing on resource issues and inclusive political participation processes in order to build on their capacity to satisfactorily negotiate on behalf of their organizations and communities and to develop mutually beneficial sustainable options. The former draft declaration and now the UN declaration, as well as the Millennium Development Goals and reports and UN reports and dialogue processes over natural resources, are provided to each participant as reference materials in their handbook for the training. We are very pleased that a number of UNITAR graduates have played key constructive roles in dialogue processes with governments in the process leading to the adoption of the UN declaration. Eight permanent forum members, including the chair, have served as resource persons for UNITAR training programs. We are also pleased to have the important contribution of permanent forum member and rapporteur, Professor Mick Dodson, at the Regional Training for Indigenous Representatives of the Pacific. We are also very grateful to the governments of Denmark, Finland, Norway, Sweden, and Switzerland for their support that made the 2007 Regional Training Program for Indigenous Representatives of the Pacific possible. More information on the regional training will be provided at the session on the Pacific region. UNITAR contributes to interagency support group and UN efforts to promote the increased involvement of Indigenous peoples in development processes at multiple levels. The continued economic, political, and social marginalization many Indigenous peoples face and pressing environmental concerns necessitate constructive approaches to promote and protect their rights and the further development of mechanisms to engage in processes and decisions that affect them. With the adoption of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, its successful implementation to improve the quality of life in Indigenous communities will continue to be a priority area. Thank you.
Merci, Tricia.
Thank you, Tricia. And now we'll give the floor to Mr. Douglas Nakashima from UNESCO.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, Indigenous representatives, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. UNESCO's broad mandate touches upon several issues of relevance to Indigenous peoples relating to education, the natural sciences, the social and human sciences, culture, and communication and information. Before specifically addressing climate change, the special theme of this seventh session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, UNESCO wishes to report on an outcome from its last general conference that is of relevance to this forum. In October 2007, at UNESCO's General Conference, held once every 2 years, the 199 member states and associate members of UNESCO debated and approved a new medium-term strategy covering the period 2008 to 2013. The approved UNESCO strategy opens with an identification of program priorities. Alongside the key priorities of Africa and gender equality, UNESCO's member states also agreed, and I quote, to respond with priority to the needs of disadvantaged and excluded groups, as well as the most vulnerable segments of society, including Indigenous peoples, end of quote. This prioritization of indigenous peoples' concerns in UNESCO's program for the coming 6 years is an encouraging development, which dovetails with the adoption by the UN General Assembly of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. In addition, it coincides with a reinforced commitment by UNESCO to contribute, in its areas of competence, to the UN system-wide mobilization to combat climate change. As a result, Indigenous peoples' concerns about climate change are an emerging and important area of work for the organization. UNESCO has been contributing for many years to international efforts with respect to climate change, but until recently, this work has focused on climate science, notably through UNESCO's Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission and its key role in the global ocean observing system. Although these contributions are important, they have remained remote from the core concerns of indigenous peoples. However, in the international community as a whole, as well as within UNESCO, the focus of climate change work is now shifting. Following the lead of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, global attention is now being directed towards efforts to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions and, most importantly, for indigenous peoples to assist vulnerable communities to adapt to changes brought about by global warming. Accordingly, at the Executive Board meeting that ended just last week, UNESCO's 58 board members adopted the UNESCO Strategy for Action on Climate Change. This multidisciplinary strategy is based upon two pillars: development of a sound and unbiased knowledge base on climate change and application of educational tools and public awareness activities to strengthen adaptation to climate change within a framework of sustainable development. With respect to indigenous peoples, it is noteworthy that the UNESCO strategy makes explicit reference to, and I quote, local and indigenous knowledge systems, including local-level climate observations, understanding strategies devised by local communities to cope with changing environments, and identifying needs and ensuring the relevance of adaptation measures for vulnerable populations in remote areas such as small islands, high altitudes, humid tropics, and the circumpolar north. UNESCO's work with respect to indigenous peoples and climate change focuses upon generating international recognition for the valuable contribution that indigenous knowledge and practice can make to understanding climate change processes. Indeed, the fine-grained and context-rich observations of indigenous communities provide a valuable counterpart to the global but coarse-grained observation provided by scientific research. Furthermore, indigenous observations are attuned to local concerns and livelihood priorities, which make them infinitely more useful when assessing community-level impacts and options for adaptation. Finally, local observations are anchored in intergenerational interactions with social and ecological landscapes. As a result, they provide long-term and nuanced understandings of the complexities of environmental change, of which human-accelerated climate change is only the most recent of a multitude of contributing factors. Indeed, while current warming trends promise to be unprecedented, environmental and climatic change is not by any means a new phenomenon for indigenous peoples. All indigenous groups have extensive experience with responding to and negotiating such changes by modifying existing practices, shifting resource bases, restructuring relationships with the environment, or altering their land use or settlement patterns. This in-depth knowledge of how to cope with environmental change must also be recognized. It provides an essential foundation for community efforts to adapt to this most recent chapter of global environmental change, albeit change that will bring transformations at a scale never before witnessed by contemporary societies. Climate change is also exacerbating climate variability, increasing the frequency and intensity of extreme climate events. This translates into the increased frequency and gravity of natural disasters. Indigenous knowledge has already demonstrated its considerable potential for disaster risk reduction, notably by saving entire communities from the deadly destruction of the 2004 tsunami in South and Southeast Asia. While tsunamis are unrelated to climate change, they nonetheless illustrate effectively how the resilience of indigenous communities is bolstered by traditional expertise in monitoring the environment, including the detection of early warning signals rooted in intimate observations of nature. Here again, indigenous knowledge and practice provide the basis for effective climate change adaptation by reducing vulnerabilities to natural disasters. Some recent examples of UNESCO work relating to indigenous peoples and climate change include, within the framework of UNESCO's work on world heritage, an international expert meeting on world heritage in the Arctic that was held in Narvik, Norway in November 2007. 27 experts participated from 8 Arctic Rim countries, including indigenous representatives of the Sami Council, Inuit Circumpolar Council, Inuit Circumpolar Conference, Russian Association of Indigenous Peoples of the North, and Gwich'in Council International, as well as representatives of UNEP and international natural and cultural heritage NGOs and foundations. The meeting welcomed the World Heritage Policy Document on the impacts of climate change on world heritage properties and recommended that further attention be given to climate change impacts on the natural and cultural heritage of the Arctic due to their specific vulnerabilities. Within the framework of UNESCO's Local Indigenous Knowledge Systems, or LINCS program, an international expert meeting on indigenous knowledge and changing environments was organized in Cairns, Australia in August 2007 with the support of the Christensen Fund and the Australian National Commission for UNESCO. Indigenous peoples and specialists from both the natural and social sciences presented case studies that illustrate how indigenous communities cope with changing environments as mediated by their indigenous knowledge. In many parts of the world, climate change is expected to exacerbate competition and conflict with respect to access to fresh water, whether for human consumption, raising livestock, irrigation, or other ecosystem services. In August 2007, at the 6th Inter-American Dialogue on Water Management, Guatemala City, UNESCO's LINCS and Water Sciences Program, in cooperation with the culture sector, launched El Agua y los Pueblos Indígenas, the Spanish version of the publication Water and Indigenous Peoples. This publication brings to the fore indigenous contributions to international debates on water access, use, and management, including powerful statements by the President of Bolivia, Evo Morales, and the Chair of the Permanent Forum, Victoria Tauli Corpus. And there will be copies, some copies of that publication available at the back of the room. Another initiative that is currently underway relates to indigenous knowledge and disaster risk reduction. UNESCO and Kyoto University, as mentioned by my colleague, are collaborating in an activity led by the Secretariat of the UN International Strategy for Disaster Reduction through its Office for Asia and the Pacific. This endeavor focuses on the use of successful practices and lessons learned from indigenous communities as a basis for disaster risk reduction, education, and policymaking within the framework of the current decade of education for sustainable development. Good practices are being compiled, and a regional workshop on indigenous knowledge for disaster risk reduction is tentatively planned for the fall of 2008 in Bangkok, Thailand. To conclude, I am pleased to announce the imminent launching of a global internet-based forum on climate change and vulnerable communities, with a particular focus on the needs and concerns of indigenous peoples living in small islands, the Arctic, montane zones, dry lands, the humid tropics, and other environments susceptible to early impacts from climate change. The forum, entitled On the Front Lines of Climate Change, is a joint effort of UNESCO, the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, the Secretary of the Convention on Biological Diversity, and the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. Its aim is to provide a first response to indigenous protests, such as those that we heard at the UN conference in Bali in December 2007, about being largely excluded from international climate change debates. The forum will offer a platform for indigenous and other vulnerable communities to exchange their observations and interpretations of climate change impacts and adaptation, while heightening international recognition and appreciation of the vital role to be played by indigenous observations and innovations. The forum, which will operate in 3 languages, English, Spanish, and French, will also address critical climate change issues such as the positive and negative impacts on indigenous communities of mitigation measures, the human rights and gender dimensions of climate change, and the impacts of climate change upon knowledge relevant for the conservation of biological and cultural diversity. We invite all interested persons who would like to participate in the Front Lines Forum to sign up by sending an email to links@unesco.org. We'll have some flyers available in the back of the room. We look forward to collaborating in this initiative on indigenous peoples and climate change and the climate change challenge. Thank you for your attention.
Very much. Thank you, Douglas Nakashima, from the UNESCO. I'd like now to call on the United Nations University, Mr. Sam Johnston. You have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. The United Nations University's mandate is to provide research and training on emerging issues for the UN system. We aim to provide policy-relevant information and analysis in a neutral and impartial manner. As the only official part of the UN with academic independence, we provide a unique bridge between the wider community and the UN. An important area for UNU is the challenges that Indigenous people face in the modern world. A focus for our work in this area is the establishment of a UNU research centre on traditional knowledge. Key aims of the UNU TK Centre would be to support Indigenous leadership at the international level, raise awareness about the importance of traditional knowledge, and provide a focal point for promoting research and training on issues regarding the retention, maintenance, and promotion of traditional knowledge. To demonstrate the type of contribution a UNU Centre could make on this topic, we have initiated a number of pilot activities. These pilot activities are looking at various issues within the topics of climate change, water management, and raising awareness about international activities amongst Indigenous people. Details about our activities can be found at our website, www.unutki.org. For this meeting of the forum, a key pilot activity of UNU was the International Expert Group meeting on Indigenous people and climate change held in Darwin, Australia in April this year, convened with the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and NAILSMA, the North Australian Indigenous Land and Sea Management Alliance. The meeting addressed the effects of climate change on Indigenous people, mitigations and adaptation measures, carbon markets, and factors affecting Indigenous people, Indigenous participation in the climate change processes. The report of this meeting is before you in document conference room paper number 9. 52 experts from around the world participated in this meeting and adopted 17 recommendations. First and foremost amongst the recommendations was that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People be used as the overarching framework for climate change policies that affect Indigenous people, thus echoing your highlights, Madam Chairperson, of your report earlier this afternoon. The experts also rejected the view that Indigenous people are passive victims of climate change, but are key actors, provide many of the solutions, and in many areas lead the way. As you also highlighted in your introduction, the experts called for the full and effective participation of Indigenous people in the development of policies and other strategies to address mitigation and adaptation measures. In particular, the processes leading up to the 15th meeting of the Climate Change Conference of the Parties in 2009. The experts also called for the full and effective participation of Indigenous people in research and information about climate change, particularly the social and economic impacts of climate change. The International Expert Group saw, like you, Madam Chairperson, that promoting Indigenous assessments of the impacts of climate change and the responses that are developed as a crucial task for this forum and for those involved, for those of us involved in supporting the forum's work on climate change. UNU is committed to providing support to these endeavours and has a number of activities underway that aim to do this. For example, UNU is playing an important role in the follow-up to the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. And within this process, we'll be working to ensure that there are Indigenous assessments of these issues. As many of you know, we began the initiative to establish the TK Centre in 2004. This process has undertaken an extensive range of consultations, including raising the matter at the fifth session of the forum. We also are hosting a side event tomorrow at lunchtime to seek views of participants at this meeting of the forum. These consultations have revealed a widespread support for the establishment of a UNU Centre on Traditional Knowledge. As a result of these consultations, UNU decided to explore the feasibility of establishing a decentralised institute that would be hosted at Charles Darwin University in Darwin, Australia. We are also exploring the possibilities of additional nodes for this centre in several neighbouring developing countries. I would like to take the opportunity to thank and support the interest from all of those who have contributed to our work on this project so far. I would particularly like to thank the Christensen Fund, as well as the people and government of the Northern Territory in Australia for their intellectual and financial support. An important outstanding issue is the political and legal support of the federal government of Australia, though. The next meeting of the UNU Council is in December 2008. Political and legal support from the Australian government is needed before then if this initiative is to be assured of success. Any support this forum and its participants could provide to persuade the federal government of Australia to support this initiative would be welcome and timely. Madam Chairperson, we wish you every success for this meeting of the forum and promise to do all we can to implement these recommendations, the recommendations coming out of this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Sam Johnston from the United Nations University. Several of the members of the Permanent Forum participated in the expert workshop that was organized by the UNU and the Secretariat, and I hope the recommendations that came from that report, from that workshop, will be put forward for the forum's consideration. I'd like now to call on the representative of the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, Ms. Regina Loeb, the focal point for indigenous issues. You have the floor, madam.
Thank you. Madam Chairperson, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, climate change is one of the most pressing issues of our time. However, indigenous peoples are rarely considered and much less involved in public discourse about climate change. This is extremely preoccupying given how much their livelihoods are affected by environmental shifts and crises, and especially given how little they are responsible for contributing to greenhouse emissions and such. On the contrary, indigenous peoples have relied on the environment for so many centuries that they hold specialized knowledge about how to retain and protect the resilience of the ecosystems which they inhabit. Drawing on traditional knowledge of this kind can help society at large cope with the upcoming challenges. Validating this knowledge is the first step towards integrating local practice and other technologies for a more positive and inclusive way forward. At FAO, the struggle against climate change has evolved into the dual purpose of mitigation and adaptation. In our view, efforts to offset environmental damage must be complemented by efforts to deal with the impacts that it will have on the areas central to FAO's mandate, including to protect food security, raise levels of nutrition, improve agricultural productivity, and better the conditions of rural populations. FAO recognizes the importance that indigenous peoples' livelihoods have for the protection of biodiversity and to counter detrimental effects of climate change. This link has been acknowledged by the Director General, Dr. Diouf, and by some standard setting that we have elaborated, as, for example, the Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources or the Voluntary Guidelines on the Right to Food. In 2007, FAO has supported indigenous peoples, especially in the conservation and sustainable management of agricultural biodiversity and ecosystems. Let me mention just some examples. The globally important Agricultural Heritage Systems Program. This program aims to establish the basis for the global recognition, conservation, and sustainable management of traditional agricultural practices. For the next 7 years, the program will support local stakeholders to protect and conserve their unique agricultural systems and their components. It is our hope that this will help guarantee the sustainability of traditional agricultural systems and the knowledge, culture, and biodiversity which they encompass. Cultural indicators. In an effort to document indigenous social forms and to assert the importance of biological and cultural diversity, the International Indian Treaty Council, in collaboration with other organizations and FAO, has developed cultural indicators of indigenous peoples' food and agroecological systems. These indicators reflect indigenous peoples' livelihoods, cultures, health, and quality of life, with a particular focus on the relationship between traditional practices and food systems. Among other things, they will be used to observe developments that may be threatening their livelihoods, such as those related to climate change. Land issues. Although ancestral rights to land are a cornerstone of the livelihoods of indigenous peoples, few countries have been ready to undertake their recognition. During 2007, FAO was involved in land demarcation projects in Chile and sub-Saharan Africa. Other activities were focused on improving tenure security using a participatory approach. One effort culminated in the granting of a territorial concession to a San community in Angola, and further projects with the San communities will follow. Communication for development. Two regional communication platforms for indigenous peoples have been established in Latin America and Canada to provide indigenous peoples with a forum for exchanging ideas, experiences, and advocacy efforts. One of the most significant focus points of the communication activities is on climate change and the management of natural resources. With these communication possibilities, rural communities can monitor their territories and share results with other communities. This could be a powerful tool for indigenous communities for the future in regard to upcoming climate change challenges. During this seventh session, a side event is planned where more details about communication and the communication platforms will be discussed. Finally, some of the topics that I have mentioned will be discussed at the high-level conference on world food security and the challenges of climate change and bioenergy taking place at FAO in June this year. A side event entitled Livelihood Responses to Climate Change and Bioenergy will feature an Indigenous people's contribution. Indigenous peoples will have the opportunity to discuss the importance of dialogue in climate change issues and to propose mechanisms for achieving increased cooperation and participation. Furthermore, Indigenous peoples will be able to participate in the social movements and civil society forum on climate change, agrofuels, and food sovereignty. Before I close, let me explain briefly in which way FAO has addressed the recommendations from the sixth session of the Permanent Forum. The recommendations encouraged FAO to improve the capacity of indigenous communities to support decision-making about positive health choices and to focus on widespread malnutrition among indigenous peoples. FAO has responded to these recommendations with Food Systems, the Center for Indigenous Peoples, Nutrition and Environment, together with leaders of indigenous communities and FAO, has developed 12 case studies on indigenous food systems around the world. These case studies provide examples of nutrition transitions in indigenous communities and present evidence that local resources are critical for food security, nutrition, and health of indigenous peoples. FAO is addressing food security and nutrition issues in many member countries. For example, in the Lao People's Democratic Republic, while developing a food security and nutrition strategy for the country, FAO took special needs of indigenous groups into consideration. The recommendations of the Permanent Forum related to communication have all been addressed. In conclusion, it is relevant to say that our presence here today testifies to the gravity of the situation that we all have described and to the need to do more to protect biological and cultural diversity for the benefit of climate change alleviation and indigenous livelihoods. Collaboration with and learning from indigenous peoples who make their living from the natural environment and thus possess a profound knowledge of its significance and potential benefits can be of great importance in this effort. It is our hope that more will be done to transform our personal commitment into a universal one. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Regina Lobb, the focal point for indigenous issues in the Food and Agriculture Organization. I'll now invite the representative of the World Bank, Dr. Navin Rai, lead specialist and team leader for the Social Development Department. You have the floor.
Madam Chair, members of the Permanent Forum, and distinguished delegates, the World Bank is currently formulating a strategic framework on climate change. This strategic framework will guide the World Bank policies, programs, and operations on climate change adaptation and mitigation. The World Bank World Development Report 2010 will focus on the development challenges faced by the developing countries due to climate change. We therefore believe that the deliberations of the seventh session of this permanent forum will help our institution, the World Bank, to better formulate climate change adaptation and mitigation strategies and policies, as well as to better design and implement climate change adaptation and mitigation programs. The World Bank will make a number of interventions during this seventh session, in particular on the development challenges faced by the poor in developing countries due to climate change, but also those challenges as they relate to indigenous people specifically. Today, I would reiterate 5 points on the specific issues of climate change and indigenous peoples. First, the World Bank recognizes that indigenous peoples have the smallest carbon footprint. They have contributed the least to global warming. Indigenous peoples have historically played a fundamental role in the protection of forest and conservation of biological diversities. As stated earlier by my colleague from IFAD, indigenous peoples presently manage 11% of the world's forest lands. Indigenous peoples also maintain within their lands and territories 80% of planet's biodiversity. Indigenous peoples have the customary sets of institutions, rules, and practices for the use of land and natural resources in a sustainable manner. Indigenous peoples are holders of rich traditional knowledge on how to successfully cope, in particular with local-level climate change. They have the cultural as well as political mechanisms to restore sustainable use of land and natural resources when practices have become unsustainable. Second, the World Bank recognizes that coping with warmer climate could impose heavy burden on the poor, especially in developing countries. While indigenous peoples live in resource-rich areas, they are also among the poorest globally. The World Bank previous study found a consistently high poverty rates among indigenous peoples in Latin America. Preliminary estimates of the ongoing World Bank case study are conducted in a number of countries in Africa and Asia indicate that the pattern of significant poverty gap between indigenous peoples and non-indigenous peoples will hold across the world. Being among the poorest, indigenous peoples face a high vulnerability to climate change. Thirdly, the World Bank recognizes that programs that have been proposed to mitigate and to adapt to climate change, if not properly designed, may inadvertently yet adversely affect indigenous peoples' livelihood and may also undermine their customary rights to land and natural resources. Fourth, the World Bank recognizes the critical role of indigenous peoples in the global efforts for climate change mitigation and adaptation. The World Bank, on its part, is conducting global consultations with indigenous peoples on its climate change program. Madam Chair, as you have already stated earlier, We have conducted a global consultation on forest carbon partnership facility. We are putting in place plans to carry out consultations with indigenous peoples on the World Bank Climate Change Strategic Framework. Fifth, the World Bank believes that there is an urgent need to bring together indigenous peoples' experts on climate change and the climate change scientists to exchange data and knowledge on climate change adaptation and mitigation, and to influence jointly the formulation of culturally appropriate policies on climate change. World Bank is willing to work with other partners to support this endeavor. Before I conclude my statement, Madam Chair, I also wanted to inform the Permanent Forum that the World Bank has welcomed the adoption of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples by the United Nations General Assembly. We note that the declaration sets forth a number of individual and collective rights of indigenous peoples, including their rights to culture, identity, language, employment, health, education, land, and resources. While the declaration is a non-binding instrument, we note that it calls on the states to take all appropriate measures, including legislative, to achieve its end, and we in the World Bank hope that the states will follow their vote with such measures. The declaration asks that the organs and specialized agencies of the UN system, of which World Bank is one, and other intergovernmental organizations shall contribute to the full realization of the provisions of the declaration through the mobilization of financial cooperation and technical assistance, and through establishing ways and means of ensuring participation of indigenous peoples on issues affecting them. We also note that the declaration states that indigenous peoples have the right to financial and technical assistance from states and through international cooperation for the enjoyment of their rights contained in the declaration. You will recall that the World Bank revised in May 2005 its operational policy on indigenous peoples. It is our belief that the current World Bank policy is quite supportive of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Navin Rai, representative of the World Bank. Now, our last speaker for this afternoon is the representative of the International Organization for Migration, Mr. Luca Dall'Oglio, permanent observer of the International Organization of Migration to the United Nations. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you. Madam Chairperson, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, delegates, ladies and gentlemen, and colleagues, it is with great pleasure that the International Organization for Migration addresses the Permanent Forum here today. With the opening of the Permanent Forum highlighted by the address of His Excellency President Evo Morales Aima of Bolivia, and the record number of indigenous representatives attending this year's Permanent Forum, it is a privilege to participate in this year's session. Madam Chairperson, I would like to briefly refer to three areas of our work that are particularly significant to our agenda and have marked the work of IOM on indigenous matters over the past 12 months. First, environmentally induced migration and its relevance for indigenous peoples. Second, interagency support group work on migration. And third, gaining a better understanding of indigenous peoples' migration. First, the environment. This year's special theme on climate change, biocultural diversity, and livelihoods is significant to all of us, but also has a special meaning in a migration context. As early as 1990, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change had noted that the greatest single impact of climate change could be on human migration, with millions of people displaced by shoreline erosion, coastal flooding, and agricultural disruption. For indigenous peoples, however, climate change brings about its own specific challenges that demand the attention of the international community to respond to what has been called environmental migration. As it has been researched, indigenous peoples face more vulnerability due to their remoteness in some cases, and because a number of indigenous communities rely heavily on the territories for livelihood. Thus, the initial and harshest impacts of climate change are faced by indigenous peoples, impacting their lives and their livelihoods, and prompting their migration or displacement. In either case, the marginalization of indigenous peoples is a key social determinant in worsening the impact of this phenomenon. At the operational level, IUN works with indigenous communities to address the needs of peoples affected by natural disasters and environmental crises in the context of the UN cluster approach to emergency response. The document produced by the Secretariat, information received from the United Nations system and other intergovernmental organizations, provides a number of examples of the kind of emergency response by IUM in Mexico, Colombia, and Ecuador, among others. Through these examples, it is evident how the indigenous communities can play an important role as co-authors of any plans to counteract the adverse impact of climate change on their environment. Madam Chairperson, second, interagency cooperation. In continuing its collaboration with the IASG and following up on a recommendation of the Permanent Forum in last year's session, IUM has been tasked with being a convener of a migration contact group to identify relevant ongoing work within individual agencies and to strategize on how to raise the specific issue of indigenous peoples within the migration debate. Indeed, this contact group has begun with agencies of the interagency support group sharing amongst the group the expertise and activities with indigenous peoples as it relates to migration, and we have been pleased to see the growing importance of migration in discussions regarding indigenous peoples. We now look forward to discussing with our IASG partners ways in which the migration debate can include the concerns of indigenous peoples. Of noted interest is the Global Forum on Migration and Development, to be hosted by the government of the Philippines this coming October, which will have a specific focus on protecting and empowering migrants for development. This will certainly be a key opportunity in which to raise the specific issues of indigenous peoples' migration. Lastly, and as part of IUM's growing reach in the area of indigenous peoples and migration, we have recently published the work Indigenous Roots, a framework for understanding indigenous migration, copies of which are available in the back of the room, and an electronic version of which can be found on our website. The report looks at diverse examples of indigenous peoples' migration, including internal and international migration, transborder migration of indigenous peoples, those whose communities were transected with the establishment of modern nation states and the drawing of international borders are particularly highlighted. Issues regarding sovereignty and citizenship are discussed in this report. Attention is also given to the effects of migration on indigenous peoples, looking at areas of employment, social services, housing, and identity, as well as how migration has impacted potential development avenues, such as through remittances and transnational activities. While the challenges and opportunities of indigenous migration are explored in this report, more research and data on this topic are greatly needed, not just to better inform migration policies, but also for indigenous leaders to gain a better understanding of this phenomenon, to communicate better their messages, and to better manage the cultural change that comes with migration. We hope that this report will catalyze further research on this worthy topic. Madam Chairperson, in conclusion, we would be remiss if we did not highlight the importance of the recent adoption of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Article 41 of the Declaration looks to the UN and other intergovernmental organizations to contribute to the full realization of the provisions of this declaration through the mobilization inter alia of financial cooperation and technical assistance. For IUM, this is an opportunity to further engage with indigenous peoples. I thank you for your attention.
Before I conclude this meeting, I'd like to ask our secretary to make some few announcements.
Thank you. There will be the meeting of Global Caucus tomorrow from 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the morning in this very room, conference room 2. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I would like to first apologize to my colleagues for not having enough time for you to raise your comments, but tomorrow morning we will use the first few minutes for that, and then we will move on to the brief responses from the agencies. I would like to thank the agencies for all their contributions this afternoon. I am sure we have a lot of material that we can think about for our work in these coming days. And we have reached the time limit for this meeting, so I would like to just announce that tomorrow morning at 10, we will start the session on time, and this will be the dialogue with Indigenous peoples on item 3. But we will take up the issues, the questions that have been raised earlier. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I would like also to remind my distinguished colleagues that we are going to have a meeting with the Interagency Support Group in room 7 tomorrow at 8:30. So please be here before that time so that we will start the meeting early with them. We might even be able to take up some of the questions that you have raised with them during that meeting. Okay? So this meeting is adjourned. We'll see you at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.